Thank you. Good morning to the speakers and members of the press. My name is Gloria Lariva. I'm coordinator of the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five, and I will be conducting today's press conference. Our speakers this morning are Bill Norris, attorney for Ramon Labañino, Phil Horowitz, attorney for Rene Gonzalez, and Richard Clue, attorney for Gerardo Hernandez. I would like to begin, on behalf of everyone on the call, by giving homage to the almost 3,000 victims of the September 11 attacks 10 years ago. It was a mournful day yesterday, a very sad reminder of the terrible loss to their families and community worldwide, a loss which is never forgotten. Yesterday, the family members of the victims of another terrorist attack, which was the mid-air bombing of the Cuban airliner on October 6th, 1976, in which 73 people died, attack masterminded by the terrorist Luis Posada Carrizales. Those family members issued a letter of condolence to the victims' families of September 11th. I'd like to read an excerpt before we start from the letter of the Cuban families, which they wish to be conveyed to the American people. The letter says, "We accompany you in your feelings. Let us unite our efforts so that other families do not have to cry over the loss of their loved ones as a consequence of terrorist attacks. The images transmitted by television worldwide filled us with anguish and pain, and it revived the memories of the death of our families who were victims of a terrorist attack perpetrated against a Cuban civilian airliner. One of the masterminds, Luis Posada Carriles, enjoys complete impunity in the United States." And the letter concludes, September 11th, 2001, the sad date that we feel as ours. That is part of the letter of the Committee of Family Members of the Victims of the Cuban Airliner Bombing. Preventing terrorism is precisely why the Cuban Five were in Miami. Gerardo Hernandez, Ramon Labañino, Antonio Guerrero, Fernando Gonzalez, and Rene Gonzalez were on a mission of preventing terrorism, saving lives, and keeping the peace. Their arrest 13 years ago today was an ignominious day for the United States. And today we are going to hear from the attorneys who will describe the current appeals, the habeas corpus appeals, three of the five, and upcoming appeals of the others. And we will also hear about the impending release of Rene Gonzalez on October 7th from his attorney. I wish to say that in the 10 years of struggle after their unjust conviction in 2001, the worldwide and United States national campaign for their freedom continues unabated. We will not stop until our brothers are home free in Cuba with their family and with the people of Cuba who they were protecting. They have resisted constant pressure from the U.S. government. The Cuban Five have maintained really actively on their mission, expressing their continued defense of the people and of anybody who would be a victim of terrorism. Now we will hear from our first speaker, who is Bill Norris, and he's the trial and appeals attorney for Ramon Labañino.
Good morning. My name is Bill Norris. As Ms. Lariva said, I was trial counsel for Mr. Labañino, and I've represented him on the appeals and now into the post-conviction relief, the habeas corpus phase. I was fortunate enough to host my client's wife and his two daughters in my home for dinner last night, and we reviewed the 13 years since the arrest. She and her daughters had just returned from a several-week stay at his place of incarceration for visitation, which was pursuant to a visa that was issued on humanitarian grounds by the government. They, of course, want their husband and their father home, and we talked at some length about the current status of things. And in a nutshell, what has happened is that the core impediment to a fair trial, which was the location of the trial, the venue, which was set in Miami, Florida, was a location which everyone who was candid about it recognized was not a location in which a person who was employed for any reason by the Cuban government could receive a fair trial. This was a matter which we had raised before trial based on survey data done by a research unit at Florida International University. They anticipated attitudes that were almost precisely what we encountered during the jury selection process. And indeed, as anyone who has followed this case knows, the initial panel of the court called this case a perfect storm, where the confluence of several different factors made it utterly impossible to have a fair trial in Miami. And again, for everyone who's followed the case knows, the en banc, the entire court, reversed the finding and said that it was close enough. And that took years and years of litigation. Ultimately, Mr. Labanino, my client, had his sentence reduced from life to 30 years. And 30 years for a wife and children is a long, long time. We talked about the new development in the case, which was the discovery, incidentally, by a journalist with the Miami Herald, that the same government that was prosecuting the five in Miami was paying journalists to engage in a propaganda campaign. The Office of Cuban Broadcasting, which is now based in Miami, Florida, is budgeted somewhere on the order of $34 to $37 million a year to broadcast information that is designed, according to the legislation, to destabilize the existing regime in Cuba. And what was discovered by journalists with the Miami Herald was that sums were being paid to nominally independent journalists to participate in this campaign of propaganda, and that these are also people who were writing articles that were being consumed in the very media market that our clients were being tried. Through Ms. LaRiva's efforts and the efforts of people who have been supporting her, we have developed quite a bit of information about who and what and how much people paid. And although the sums are not extraordinary, the concept of paying a journalist to espouse an opinion which is fairly virulently anti-Cuba, and to have the government making those payments to nominally independent journalists who are also writing within the media market is an idea which really seems to be the antithesis of the concept of fair trial. The government is allowed to prosecute people, that's fine, but to pour gasoline on the fire with a propaganda campaign exceeds the concept of due process. Also, speaking as Mr. Labanino's trial attorney, my ability to effectively represent my client at trial in Miami, Florida, without that knowledge, in other words, I had no idea that the government was paying journalists, the very people who were writing these articles that were excoriated my client, were in fact on the government's payroll. I think that had that fact been known, our attempts to change the venue of trial to anywhere else in the United States, even anywhere else in the state of Florida, probably would have met with success. And had we had a jury that was sitting in an area where they were willing to hear the case on the facts and decide on the facts, we wouldn't be having this conversation now, that my client would be home in Havana with his wife and with his daughters. And that is my hope after 13 years, that we can look with some hope of success to that day coming sooner rather than later. Those are my remarks.
Thank you, Bill. We will now hear from Phil Horowitz, who was the trial and is the appeals attorney for Rene Gonzalez.
Good morning, everyone. As you're aware, this has been a 13-year ordeal for Rene Gonzalez, and it is an anniversary date that he does not celebrate. However, Rene's time and his sentence is due to expire. He is set to be released on October 7th of this year. He looks forward to his release. His family looks forward to having him back. However, he will be leaving his four brothers in Ramon, Fernando, Gerardo, and Antonio behind, and he will continue to fight and to be of assistance to his four brothers. However, with his 15-year sentence, October 7th remains his release date, and his family, his brother, his parents, his wife, and his children look forward to having him released. Thank you very much. Hello?
Okay.
Yep, sorry about that, Gloria. That's pretty much what I have.
Okay, and if you could stay on the line for any questions.
Sure.
Next, we will hear from Richard Clue, attorney for Gerardo Hernandez, and he was also involved in the time of the trial. Thank you, Richard.
Hello, my name is Richard Clue. I'm an attorney in Miami. I am one of the attorneys for Gerardo Hernandez, and can also speak to the pending cases of the other two of the five, Antonio Guerrero and Fernando Gonzalez. The all of the cases are either in the process of being litigated as part of the 22, what is called a 2255 or habeas corpus process in federal court. In the cases of Antonio Guerrero and Gerardo Hernandez, evidentiary hearings have been requested, and we are looking forward to further litigating those cases. We presented a considerable amount of new arguments with regard to these matters, and it is our hope that we can further advance these arguments in the course of evidentiary proceedings.
Yes. Richard, could you explain a little bit more about the key issues for Gerardo's appeal and what you would hope in the evidentiary hearing?
Well, as Bill North mentioned, we are addressing the issue of the unique situation of payment of journalists by the United States to essentially advance an agenda that was hostile to the defendants while they were on trial. That's a unique situation in American criminal history. It related to the uniqueness of the fact that the case was tried in Miami, which is, of course, the seat of the exile and anti-Castro and anti-government movement and political structure in the United States. And the fact that, again, we were not able to obtain a transfer of the trial to any other jurisdiction in the other district, at one point, the Court of Appeals had held that in and of itself was error. But at the time the court ruled, and the decision was later overturned by an en banc court, the court was not aware, the appellate court was not aware, the government had not advised either the district court or the Court of Appeals that besides everything else that had convinced originally a unanimous panel of the Court of Appeals that the trial was unfair to have it in Miami, that the government had failed to tell the district court, had failed to tell the defendants, and had failed to tell the Court of Appeals that they had an ongoing paid program that caused an even greater level of communication of media influence that adversely impacted the venue, so that we had the type of unique factors in this case that that again take it out of the ordinary course of cases, and the failure to disclose that information, as well as the magnitude of the financial involvement of the United States in promoting those issues, is one that we feel absolutely requires a new trial. With regard to Gerardo specifically, there is a we recently filed an affidavit filed by his attorney at trial, explaining certain errors that caused his inability to present Gerardo Hernandez's own testimony at trial and additional evidence, affirmative evidence of his innocence, certain misunderstandings with regard to what the charges he was facing were, so that he was unable to effectively present the defense of actual innocence. The issues that at trial became bogged down in what were essentially various sorts of anecdotal claims with regard to exactly where the shooting happened, and that became a he said, she said, where one side was U.S. sources and the other side was Cuban sources. And the trial became bogged down on that issue, as the jurors indicated afterwards, and rather than the issue of whether Gerardo Hernandez personally knew about or participated or wanted to occur any sort of attack or violence or otherwise with regard to incursions of aircraft into Cuban territory. And the attorney's very candid recognition of the errors and omissions that caused the failure to present the defense of actual innocence is one that we feel is tremendously important, because apart from all of the other repercussions of the case and all of the implications of the case that it may have that may be obvious to everyone, the political import of the prosecution, the individual question of guilt or innocence is one also that is of such paramount importance that you know, we hope to finally establish as a matter of absolute fact that Gerardo did not in any way participate in, know of, or seek to advance any crime against any person, and certainly not the people who were there in that incident.
Thank you, Richard. Before we begin the question and answer period, we want to announce that there has been a 2.5-year effort by the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five, by the Liberation Newspaper, as well as Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, the attorneys which have been most helpful in filing appeals to the Freedom of Information Acts of the National Committee and Liberation Newspaper in seeking all the documentation, the grants, the payments, the purchase orders, and the proof of the government secret payment to Miami journalists who, as the attorneys have stated, were illegally receiving money while they were covering the case in the most harmful manner to the Cuban Five during their prosecution. On Friday, September 8th, actually, the Partnership for Civil Justice received a letter from the U.S. State Department denying the Partnership for Civil Justice the expeditious processing of the Freedom of Information Act request on the information of the journalists. And it's really astounding, because the PCJ had indicated and argued in their appeals letter that there is, quote, an imminent threat to the life and physical safety of individuals and a matter of substantial humanitarian reasons to justify the expeditious processing, unquote. Now, that imminent threat is to the life of the Cuban Five who are in prison, and especially regarding the case of Gerardo Hernandez, who is serving double life. because of its egregious media coverage. Well, the State Department has denied it, saying that they do not demonstrate sufficient justification to warrant the expeditious processing. It will continue on further appeals and action by the Partnership for Civil Justice, but we think this is an urgent matter for the government to reveal its role in helping create this harmful and prejudicial atmosphere, which made a fair trial in Miami really impossible. Now, the documentation of these letters and the appeal, as well as all the contracts of the government that we've been able to uncover so far, and the dozens of articles by these Miami journalists, is on the website reportersforhire.org. And this newest information is also on that website. We will open now for questions and answers.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. There may be a delay before the first question is announced. If you're using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. Just a moment, please. At this time, we have a question from Bert Anderson from the Associated Press. Please go ahead.
It's Kurt, actually, Kurt Anderson. This is for Mr. Horowitz. I wanted to ask you what your understanding is of how the government will repatriate Mr. Gonzalez or deal with him after his release. Have you been part of any discussions about how that's going to be handled and what might transpire once he gets out of prison?
Good morning, Kurt. As you may recall, Renee is a United States citizen. And he is due to be released and commence serving his 3 years of supervised release which is analogous to probation on October 7th.
Mm-hmm.
Back in March, I'm sorry, February, I filed a motion for Renee to be permitted to return to Cuba. As you also are aware, in addition to being a United States citizen, Renee is a Cuban citizen, therefore holds dual citizenship. His wife, who is unable to travel to the United States, having been deported, so she can't visit him. His elderly parents reside in Cuba. Both his children live in Cuba. His brother and his family also live in Cuba. He has no relatives, no close family in the United States. As with most people who have citizenship outside, other than the United States, they usually get deported and are allowed to serve their supervised release in a non-reporting fashion in their home country with their loved ones. And I filed a similar motion requesting the same thing for Renee. And this is back in February. The government has filed a response to that motion in opposition. And unbelievably, they want Renee to remain in the United States to serve his 3 years of supervised release, which is our contention that it's 3 years of additional punishment being away from his family. We filed a reply to that motion in April, and the matter remained pending with Judge Leonard.
So it's before Judge Leonard as well?
Correct. It's in the form of a motion to modify Renee's supervised release to allow him to return to Cuba.
Yeah, interesting. I wasn't aware of that. Now, can I ask one follow-up on that?
Sure, Kurt.
Do you feel that there's an element here of any kind of threat or danger to him as well, if he's released and is forced to stay in, say, South Florida?
I would hope not.
Okay, that's all I got for now.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Barney Dwyer from Radio Havana, Cuba.
Yes, hello. My question is also to do with Rene Gonzalez, so I'd like to ask Phil, please, if there could be any chance that if maybe René González renounced his U.S. citizenship, would that affect his status under his probation act?
Good morning. How are you today?
Good morning, Philip. Thank you.
Good. Let me see if I can explain this to you. If René was to renounce his United States citizenship before his release, while he remains in the United States, he would therefore no longer be a United States citizen and be solely a citizen of Cuba. As a result, he would not be released on October 7th because he would be considered a foreigner in a United States prison who would have to go through deportation proceedings and then would be released. Obviously, we're trying to avoid that. It is my client's position that he is willing to renounce his citizenship if that allows him to have dinner with his family in Havana on October 7th. His goal is to return home to Cuba, home to Olga, home to Ermita and Yvette, and to his parents. That's Renee's goal. And if it means renouncing his United States citizenship, if that's what it takes to return home to Cuba, that's what it takes.
And the deportation process, would that be a long process, do you know?
He would remain in custody pending deportation. And that's not something I think Renee should have to do, having spent the last 13 calendar years in a federal prison.
Okay, many thanks.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Peter Roman from City University. Please go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted another question for Horowitz. Renee's mother expressed fear about his safety. And I know one of the questions was...
Hello? Can everybody hear me?
Just a moment, please.
I just didn't get the rest of the last question.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, one of the questions was about, you know, whether he would be in danger, and his mother expressed fear about that. Would he? Could you elaborate on her fears? And because we're really concerned about that, and would he be in Miami, or that's not known yet?
Well, I'm hopeful that he's going to be in Havana.
Yeah, I know that, but you know, these people are not nice people. So,
well, you know, I would hope that if he is ultimately, let's say, residing in South Florida, which obviously I still don't know that to be the case or that not to be the case upon his release.
Okay.
I would hope that we live in a more civilized society than to have a person literally who has, according to the United States government, paid for their crime.
Yeah.
Has spent 13 years in federal prison. That I would hope that society is more mature than that.
But there's a danger there, too. And his mother, I think, you know, being
familiar. His mother clearly perceives a danger.
Yeah.
And
are there any measures that could be taken, or you don't know that?
I wouldn't want to speculate on that.
Okay. Anyway, we're really concerned about that, so I just wanted to ask you. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Mary Alice Waters from The Militant.
Okay, thank you. I have a question. It's a two-part question on the timing things involved here. Phil Horowitz referred to the, this is all the, concerning Renee, that the motion to allow him to permission to leave is pending before Judge Leonard. What do you expect on the timing on this, on decision? I assume it has to be decided, or does it have to be decided before he's released, and so forth? Is there any other government agency involved on, you know, parole conditions or whatever the accurate term is on that? as to where he would have to live and so forth if he were not allowed to leave. And then the second question is on the timing is related, is for Richard Clue on the what is the anticipation at this point, the extent that it's possible to have to know of the learn of knowing whether or not there's any possibility of the evidentiary hearing on these and the possibility of making the, I believe that's the next step, making oral arguments in favor of the new trial. But if I'm wrong, please correct me.
Can I go first, Richard?
This is Bill Norris. I got dropped. I just came back on. Is Richard on the line?
Well, if Richard's not on the line, maybe I can answer the question that was addressed for Renee.
Okay.
And if I can, I know that had a bunch of parts, so if I miss
one
part, please remind me. As far as upon release, if Renee is to remain in the United States, he will be supervised by a probation officer with the United States Probation Office. That's who supervises his supervised release or probation. I know that was part of the question.
Yes.
The second question, I think, as far as timing for Judge Leonard's ruling, the answer to that question is she could rule today, tomorrow, or October 6th, or October 7th, or October 8th. It is up to the judge to rule on the motions pending before her.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't speak to the judge as far as timing is concerned.
And with regard to the same answers would essentially apply to timing of the other matters. One fact is important that Fernando Gonzalez will be filing his habeas petition on September 16th, and it is very possible that some of these issues will be handled jointly. And so it may await the government's filing of a response and a full briefing of Fernando's and that of Ramon Labanino before any scheduling is considered as the evidentiary hearings and that sort of thing.
Can I follow up with on that front? Is the next step? They can either grant an evidentiary hearing or deny it. Is that correct?
The court can the statute provides for an evidentiary hearing unless the facts are not in dispute. So to that extent, the statute points towards an evidentiary hearing. Occasionally, district judges will have a non-evidentiary hearing preliminary to conducting an evidentiary hearing. Or we'll try to resolve issues otherwise through a non-evidentiary hearing, and so that it's always an individualized decision by the district judge, with the prevailing understanding that the statute requires an evidentiary hearing in most cases.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'd like to make a point. This is Gloria Lariva, and it's very, very important for people to understand, as Phil Horowitz mentioned, that Olga Salanueva, Renee's wife, is not able to see him because she's been denied entry to the United States since she was deported in 2000. And this is punitive punishment by the U.S. This is extra punishment on the five and their families. But in addition, Adriana Perez, the wife of Gerardo Hernandez, who is sentenced to double life, she has been denied entry to the United States to see her husband. And so conceivably, the U.S. intends for them never to see each other again. She has tried numerous times, along with Olga, to get a visa by the U.S. government, which has denied her each time. I'd like to point out that there is a very beautiful interview with her, a very warm and heart-rending interview, on the website freethefive.org. It's in Spanish right now, but we will have it in English by the end of the day to remind people of the additional suffering of the Cuban Five families by the U.S. government, which is completely needless and deliberate by Washington.
Thank you. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touchtone phone. Thank you. Just one moment, please. Thank you. At this time, we have a question from Ben Becker from the Liberation newspaper.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to ask Richard Clue what he hopes to find from the evidentiary hearings for Gerardo Hernandez, and beyond that, what are the prospects for him if the judge were to deny his appeals for justice?
We still hope to establish, and we've still requested discovery of material that's never been produced by the United States, including satellite imagery regarding the issue of the shoot down, which we feel would either exonerate him on its own or would help to show that there was that the version offered by the United States with regard to the actual maneuvering of the of the aircraft in this case in some way supported the government theory. Apart from that, we hope to establish further evidence of the payment of the journalists and the program and its scope and its purpose and its effect and the analyses, the internal analyses of the government, the United States government, of how effective it's been and how it is affected journalism. We feel that there is a great deal more to reveal with regard to that area of the prejudice, of the local prejudice. And perhaps most importantly, the evidentiary hearing will establish credibly the full scope of the inability of counsel to have established Gerardo's innocence of involvement due to misunderstandings both of the law through legal rulings, we believe through certain actions of the government that confused the jury with regard to the instructions and as to the limitations of the issues, and certain fundamental preclusions of offering of testimony, particularly testimony of Gerardo, that was essential to show that he had nothing to do with it. As well as taking discovery of additional wire communications, non-wire communications, rather, that the government had to place in further context the understanding that Gerardo had in that period of what was going on and that he had no role in the offense. All of those things will contribute, I think, to a full and complete record of both the unfairness of holding the trial in Miami, the failure to disclose essential evidence pertinent to both the claims of a shoot-down and certain claims of a conspiracy to commit espionage, because, again, this is a unique prosecution conspiracy to obtain espionage where the government admitted there was never, in all of the years that the agents were here, there was never even a single attempt to obtain any classified information whatsoever. So it was a very unique prosecution. Very difficult to defend in that regard, and how it affected the defense of the other counts, particularly the defense of the again unique claim that the action of another country's air force should be attributed to a field agent in the United States. So we hope to develop all of those areas, and we feel that we've established through affidavits and through other indications that the evidence is there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Barney Dwyer from Radio Havana, Cuba.
Yes, please. Richard, if you don't mind, or if there's anybody else who can answer this, if you could just explain a little bit more about the misunderstanding and what actually confused the jury in the case of Gerardo.
Well, the case was originally prosecuted by the government on a theory that the district court ruled at the last part of the case was an improper theory, that Gerardo could be found guilty of helping the Cuban government obtain information to enforce its own laws. And what happened was that at the finally, for that reason, the trial attorney was forced into the position of trying to disprove that it even happened within jurisdiction, because he thought that, well, that way I can avoid whatever wild theory the government is seeking to apply. But by the time the district court ruled on it and tried to clarify the law on the issue, the government just sought an emergency appeal in the 11th Circuit, saying that they can't prove their case if all the evidence is that Gerardo was tasked with providing Cuba information that would allow it to enforce its own laws in its own territory. The 11th Circuit did not issue a written ruling on it, but essentially denied the government's claim, acknowledging the government's admission that it couldn't prove its case. But when the case came back, unfortunately, due to some truly remarkable confusion, the jury never learned that improper theory was taken out of the case. And so the jury was left to believe that it could convict an agent of doing nothing more than providing what he believed was information that his government intended to use lawfully in the defense of its own territory. And for that reason, there was so much evidence that Mr. McKenna could have produced, and so much testimony, he would have had so much of a greater opportunity and an interest in presenting the full picture rather than trying to defend a case that the law did not become seemingly clarified until the last minute, and which in fact was not clarified to the jury. So you have that's just one aspect of the problem that you have with a case like this, because again, when you have a politically motivated prosecution, you have prosecutors straining to find theories that will accommodate their desired prosecution. You have them filing what was again a unique petition for writ of prohibition in the 11th Circuit during trial. You never have the government appealing to a court of appeals during trial saying that they can't prove the case if the district judge instructs the jury correctly. And then the failure of the attorney to ensure that the jury accurately was instructed. And as his affidavit reflects, he's heartbroken over the fact that now looking back on it, his argument was completely misplaced because, again, the jury was not instructed in accordance with what the government believed that the jury would be instructed. And so it's such a fundamental injustice from so many angles, but particularly from the angle of the fact that he's actually innocent.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you, Richard.
I would like to ask Bill Norris a question about the issue of the journalist and your memorandum for Ramon Labanino, which was just filed, and I recommend that the press read it when it's available on our website. And that is the matter of the judge's lack of knowledge about the government paying these journalists and some of what she even stated in court about this. And is this a unique situation about such a bank of journalists on the government payroll during the prosecution?
Yes, I believe that it is unique. It's certainly extraordinary. The United States government, in the days after the Second World War, decided to embark on a program of propaganda, which is basically an inherently neutral term. In common usage, when you say propaganda, you're being critical. It's not necessarily critical. What all propaganda is an organized structure to deliver a coherent message that's intended to sway other people. And much of Congress was tremendously concerned about funding a governmental attempt to engage in that process. They viewed it as the antithesis of democracy, to have the government spending money to form opinions one way or the other. And as a consequence, the legislation that created Voice of America and Radio Free Europe was carefully constructed to avoid any domestic dissemination of that propaganda. when the Office of Cuban Broadcasting was created under under the auspices of Voice of America, some unique problems occurred, and that, you know, when you get into the question of radio wave propagation, which exceeded the knowledge or understanding of me as a mere lawyer. But the basic point is that if you have a radio broadcast that can be picked up anywhere in Cuba, it obviously can be picked up anywhere in Miami. And that's accentuated by the fact that the Office of Cuban Broadcasting actually was using commercial broadcast sites located in the very county in which these defendants were prosecuted. So the signal strength was strong enough that you could probably pick up their broadcasts on your toaster in Hialeah. That's extraordinary. The very idea that you have radio broadcasts that are designed to destabilize and change the regime in a foreign country, in the same media market that a substantial exile community from that country lives. That basic proposition is unique. The additional problem that was discovered here is that not only was the Office of Cuban Broadcasting using federal tax dollars to broadcast messages into the media market that were excoriating as far as the defendants were concerned, that these supposedly neutral statements were coming out of the mouths of journalists who were presumptively free and independent, and in fact were not. They were being paid by the Office of Cuban Broadcasting for their appearances. And that has created something of a firestorm of criticism within the journalistic community, which, as far as I'm concerned, as Ramon Labanino's lawyer, is really neither here nor there. I mean, that's an ethical question for a journalist, but as a criminal defense lawyer who's charged with representing someone who is being tried basically for his life in a community which is antagonistic to his basic mission, it becomes totally unacceptable and totally contrary to the idea of a fair and impartial trial.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Mary Alice Waters from The Militant. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask Bill Norris, it's really a follow-up on this. Were all of the payments made that there's evidence of so far made through Radio and TV Marti, or is there any other agency involved?
So far as we know, and that's the important point, okay, because the information that we've gotten is fragmentary, but so far as we have been able to learn, the payments were coming out of the Office of Cuban Broadcasting, which is the parent or umbrella organization over Radio and TV Marti. Any other payments are really beyond our ability to learn at this point. So, you know, are there or are there not? We simply have no information about that.
Thank you.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone phone.
In the meantime, we, on behalf of the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five and all their supporters around the world, the people of Cuba who have been mobilizing constantly for their brother's freedom. Our belief is that the five never belonged in prison. They never should have been arrested. They were carrying out a mission, as we said before, of saving lives. And we appreciate all the efforts these 13 long years of the attorneys. It's very unusual for trial attorneys to continue as appeals attorneys, but they believe very strongly in their right to justice and freedom. And therefore, we thank them for speaking today, explaining the case. We hope that more of the media picks this up. Our belief, as we've said all along, is that when the American people find out about the truth, the cause, and the justice of the Cuban Five, they will demand their freedom as well. We will be posting a full-page advertisement in the Washington Post soon to help relay that message, and we know there are many other actions around the world today, from protests to forums, appeals by parliamentarians and prominent individuals around the world demanding immediate freedom for the Cuban Five. We know that President Obama has that power to free them. I think we will conclude the press conference now. We thank everyone for participating. The audio will be available on the website freethefive.org in about half an hour. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes.